Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, our embarrassed brains. Sky-watching planets and meteors, 7 billion people in 2011, and the future of nuclear energy. First, a scientist soundbite.
A new way of thinking is required. I have a very optimistic sense of at least the chance of a fairly smooth ride past this mid-century peak that we're facing. And the question we have examined, which comes first, peak everything or peak us? In other words, can we kind of manage our way through to a new relationship with the planet, or are we going to have that change in our trajectory imposed upon us by limits?
That's journalist and author Andrew Revkin, who writes for the New York Times with his .Earth blog. And he's a senior fellow for environmental understanding at Pace University in New York. Earth Day is a day dedicated to raising awareness about the environment. A major force changing the planet is humans, and our population is expected to reach 7 billion people in 2011. Here to talk more about that by phone is Andrew Revkin. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
What are your thoughts on Earth Day in 2011, a year we're likely to see 7 billion people on the planet?
Well, you know, it really is kind of the best of times and the worst of times at the same time. The overarching trajectories for human affairs right now are, despite the recent turbulence, pretty good. There's fewer children dying prematurely of avoidable disease. There's longer lifespans. There's a reasonable amount of biodiversity still left to lose, which, you know, is both good and bad. But again, on things that, on a number of fronts that matter, it's pretty clear that science has delineated we're sort of approaching the edge of the petri dish, as if you looked at us like bacteria that have been plunked down on this Earth. We've been growing at a blazing pace, and now there really are signs of fundamental limits on things, including the capacity of the atmosphere to and ecosystems in the oceans to absorb greenhouse gases. And there are biological systems that are hurting.
This relates to something that you've written about a lot about, which is energy and energy quest for the right kind of energy. Earth Day was inspired in part by a response to a 1969 oil spill in California. And now looking forward 40 years with the Gulf of Oil spill in 2010, partial meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant just a month ago. Has much changed in terms of looking at these fundamental issues of energy and the environment?
Well, the common element in looking at those particular environmental and energy calamities was not taking seriously the prospect of these kind of really serious kinds of problems. Now, if you find ways to mediate that risk, then you can probably move forward with some of these options. That again, the questions there are, what do we need? How much energy can we avoid through behavior change, lifestyle change, versus how much are we just fundamentally going to need as we head again toward having 2 billion or 3 billion more people all seeking decent lives? Now, again, if we were all vegan monks, this wouldn't be such an issue, but we're not. And there's very little sign of the sort of burgeoning global middle class wanting to give up some of the modern conveniences.
What does that mean? What do you mean by that we're not all vegan monks? Explain that for us.
Well, we're not. We have high appetites. As people get less poor and then get a little more wealthy, moving through middle class, the amount of protein they eat, the amount of meat they eat goes up, and it's usually working your way up the food chain toward the most energy-intense, water-intense, land-intense sources of food, beef or bluefin tuna at the top of the ocean chain. And that's unfortunate because as everyone kind of moves toward more of that middle-class zone, then you really do get a sense that something has to give.
Okay, this year, 2011, Earth will see 7 billion people, and we're on path to 9 billion people. What is important? What is something that you really want people to think about this?
A new way of thinking is required. If you look at an issue like energy, and you just kind of always pointing at someone like Exxon or a politician, then you're missing the reality that we all need energy, and there aren't options. And so if we want to really get busy and move off of the fossil fuels of previous centuries and could go to something new and sustainable, renewable, then we have to take on that responsibility and get busy. And I see it as a very positive prospect that we are so disinvested in things like basic research and development and energy, but that it makes it really simple and easy and cheap to greatly increase that. For example, a 2-cent nudge in the gas tax would triple our R&D for energy sciences. I have a very optimistic sense of at least the chance of a fairly smooth ride toward and past this mid-century peak that we're facing. Which comes first, peak everything or peak us? In other words, can we kind of manage our way through a soft landing, a soft transition to a new relationship with the planet, or are we going to have that change in our trajectory imposed upon us by limits? That's kind of a function of how busy we want to be.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about Earth Day in a year of 7 billion people?
That there's every chance of the next 30-year period being one of great innovation and collaboration around the world, and it just takes a little bit of focus to get you engaged in that kind of the conversations and the actions that would be needed to have the brighter outcome.
That was journalist Andrew Revkin. His blog is called Dot Earth at the New York Times. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky, heard on 1,200 radio stations around the world. Ryan Britton is here with a story on weird science, and it's about a research group that has studied where the embarrassment centers are in the brain. Ryan, what's going on?
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. So I'm almost afraid to ask this, but how do you test for embarrassment within the brain?
Well, a neurobiologist at the University of California, San Francisco, created what would be a pretty embarrassing situation for most of us. They asked each participant of a study to sing the 1964 Motown classic song, My Girl by the Temptations. So researchers recorded the video of the participant singing and played it back to the participant without music this time, totally a cappella.
Ryan, care to test this with a song? I'll give you a B here.
Yeah. My girl, my girl, my girl. See, you... I'm feeling embarrassed about it already
and
right
I'm
now.
Feeling embarrassed for you.
and this karaoke, I guess you could call it a karaoke exercise, did elicit considerable embarrassment reaction in the study. It increased blood pressure, heart rate, changes in breathing. So people got embarrassed seeing themselves singing this song. So researchers also scanned the subject's brain as they were being embarrassed, and they were able to identify a little thumb-sized chunk in the front of the brain called the pregenual anterior cingulate cortex. And this little piece of tissue is essential for embarrassment.
And that's the brain tissue of embarrassment, huh?
It's looking like it is. The study also tested subjects that had these neurodegenerative diseases, and they found that the less that this part of the brain worked, the less that sort of the front part of the brain worked, the less embarrassed that the subjects were in watching themselves sing Motown tunes. So researchers theorized that using an embarrassment response might actually help us to diagnose neurodegenerative diseases in the future. You know, I'm wondering if we might one day see karaoke machines in doctor's offices. I mean, I'm down with that.
Where can people find out more about this study?
You could find information at the University of California, San Francisco Memory and Aging Center at their website, which is memory.ucsf.edu.
Well, thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton with Weird Science. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky.
I'll do it.
Boom.
Okay.
Boom.
No, it goes dung, 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 dung.
Boom, 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 boom.
I've got sunshine on a cloudy day, and a cold outside. Something about the month of May.
I'm embarrassed now. I think that's enough. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. Deborah Burr joins us now to talk about the global night sky and a grouping of five planets in the morning sky.
Jorge, this is cool, especially if you live in the Southern Hemisphere. So what's happening is that, you know, we've been talking about planets for months and months and months. We've been talking about Jupiter and Venus and Mars and all these cool planets. Well, now, if you're outside in the evening, you may be kind of scratching your head saying, where are all the planets? Where did they go? In fact, there's only one planet left in the evening sky, and that's Saturn. It's the faintest of the bright planets. Saturn is beautiful, and it's just Earth just went between Saturn and the Sun, so it's still in a good place to see. So Saturn is great in the evening sky, but where are all the other planets? And the answer is they've all moved over into the morning sky. And the cool thing about it is that they're all kind of in the same part of the sky. They're a grouping of five planets, Jupiter, Venus, Mercury, Mars, and the planet Uranus, which is just barely visible to the eye. And these planets are very low in the east at dawn by the end of April 2011. So five planets all in one spot in the morning sky.
And can anyone anywhere in the world see these five planets in the morning sky?
Well, it depends on where you are in the world. And if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, you're going to have a lot better view of the planets. The ecliptic, the path of the sun across the sky, makes a kind of a perpendicular angle to the eastern horizon before dawn, as seen from the Southern Hemisphere. So that places the planets higher up in the sky from that hemisphere. If you're in the northern hemisphere, you're going to need a really, really clear, unobstructed eastern horizon very shortly before dawn. You'll easily be able to see the planet Venus. You'll probably have no problem finding the next brightest planet, which is Jupiter. Mercury and Mars are going to be tougher to see, and you might need binoculars to see them. Uranus, which is sort of borderline visible to the eye anyway, only under the very best conditions, probably won't see that one. You just have to go, hey, it's up there. It's the fifth planet. It's there, even though I can't see it.
And these five planets that are visible in the morning sky, is there going to be a better time to see some of these brighter of the planets?
Well, actually, it's going to be really cool what happens as May progresses, May 2011. So what's going to happen is that the two brightest planets, Venus, which is the very brightest, and Jupiter, which is the second brightest, are going to be seen throughout the early part of May, getting closer and closer and closer and closer together every morning. So if you go outside and look in the east every morning before dawn, you'll see those two very bright worlds a little bit closer every day until about May 10th. And that's when they're kind of side by side, as seen from the northern hemisphere on the sky's dome in the east before dawn. After that, Venus is going to sink into the sunrise, and Jupiter is going to keep getting higher in the sky and just go on to be, you know, do its yearly cycle in Earth's sky.
Yeah, April and May are just spectacular months to see sky watching events, not only for planets, but also for meteors, I understand.
Well, I just want to say that every month is a pretty spectacular month to see something in the night sky, but you're absolutely right about meteors. Meteor season is beginning with the Lyrid meteor shower peaking on the evening of April 22nd and the morning of April 23rd. After that, the next meteor shower is the Eta Aquarid meteor shower. That's coming up on the mornings of May 5th and 6th. So if you're outside looking for the planets, you might see some meteors in the Eta Aquarid shower as well.
Great time to be a sky watcher.
No kidding.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. In March of 2011, a 9.0 earthquake and tsunami struck Japan, causing a disaster at the Fukushima nuclear power plant, which leaked dangerous radiation near the plant. This event has caused many to wonder about the future of nuclear power, which today provides about 15% of the world's electricity. Here with more is Christopher Flavin, president of the World Watch Institute, an environmental research organization that monitors resources like energy. Mr. Flavin, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, the World Watch Institute has just released a report on the nuclear industry. Tell us, what are the main findings of that report?
Well, it's interesting that there's been a lot of talk about a nuclear renaissance, and that's been referred to in the wake of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. But in fact, what we find is that the overall capacity to generate electricity of the world's nuclear plants has been really just barely increasing in recent years. And in fact, total output of electricity has even declined slightly over the last few years. So rather than being, you know, this sort of robust, rapidly growing industry, we find that nuclear power was actually facing a pretty uncertain and even somewhat troubled future even before Fukushima, which of course has now, you know, added additional question marks.
So would you give us your thoughts on kind of how nuclear energy is doing today?
Well, to just give a little bit of a historical perspective, there was very rapid growth in the use of nuclear power starting in the 60s, and the 1970s and 1980s were extremely rapid growth decades in the United States and indeed globally. And things really turned around, and interestingly, they turned around about the time of the Three Mile Island and Chernobyl disasters, which respectively occurred in 1979 and 1986. And orders for new nuclear plants began to slow dramatically worldwide. And in the United States, there actually hasn't been an order for a new nuclear plant since Chernobyl, that is, since the late 1970s, which means that there's been more than 30 years since a new plant was ordered. And the idea the nuclear industry has had is to, you know, sort of revive that and get a renaissance going. And while there's been, you know, a lot of interest on the part of companies and even some early work beginning to be done to sort of make way for a new nuclear era, in fact, there's not a single new nuclear plant that's actually under construction at this point. There's only some very early preparatory work in the U.S.
Well, right. The report says that the average age of nuclear power plants is going on a quarter century or more. What does that mean as far as how that affects the industry?
Well, there has been a very small nuclear renaissance sort of underway in China particularly. China has shown a great interest in building nuclear power plants, and really over half of the new nuclear plants under construction now are actually in China. If you take China aside and you look at the whole rest of the world, you find that there really is very little activity underway, and that there are a range of different factors going on. In some European countries, particularly Germany, there's really been a very explicit political decision not to move forward with nuclear power, but to move forward with renewable energy sources instead. In the United States, it's really been more of an economic decision. The relatively high cost of nuclear power has deterred many electric utilities, including, you know, some that had announced plans several years ago have now, in effect, set them aside. And seeing the growing cost estimates of nuclear power plants, as well as the fact that relatively inexpensive natural gas-fired power plants are now a viable option in many areas, has really taken the bloom off the nuclear renaissance.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about the future of nuclear energy?
Nuclear power really faces a very uncertain and troubled future. You know, not only are there all of the safety questions and resulting economic questions that are raised by the accident itself, but if you look around the world, the industry was really not moving forward very actively. There's a lot of confusion about what the next generation of technology is likely to be, and I think therefore we can expect, you know, very modest nuclear expansion, if that, over the coming years and decades.
That was Christopher Flavin of the World Watch Institute. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week, we recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Byrd. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Mother Falcon, The Black and White Years, Built by Snow, and 100 Flowers. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.